Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, with analysis from political scientist Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa, where he's professor of political science, and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, associate professor of political science at ISU. Jonathan, welcome to you. And Rene, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Okay, you're both on board. Very good. Hearing both of your voices just fine. And going to be covering a lot of ground this hour. This evening, of course, President Biden giving his first address before a joint session of Congress. A preview of that this hour. Also, analysis of his first 100 days, the view from Rene and Jonathan. And we'd like to have you join us in this hour of political conversation. What's your reaction to Joe Biden's nearly first 100 days in office? Has there been a surprise that you'd like to point out or ask about? And what do you most want to hear from President Biden this evening? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the southern border crisis, also the politics of policing reform, and a bill in the Iowa legislature that's advancing to limit so-called vaccine passports. But first of all, let's get to the Biden administration marking this admittedly artificial milestone. Gets a lot of attention, no actual significance, 100 days in office, for better or worse. It's become a time-honored tradition in Washington. Thanks to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We'll discuss that in depth, the history of this 100-day benchmark tomorrow on this program with two presidential historians, Tim Naftali and Tim Walch. But for today, let's get our political analysts' thoughts on this, what is today, the 98th day of the Biden presidency. Rene, start us off. How has Biden fared so far?
Well, he's doing pretty well. If you look at his approval rating, he's hovering in the low 50s, which by historical standards might not be that high. But when you consider the approval ratings of his immediate predecessors, former President Trump and Obama, 53 is pretty good. And so I think that speaks to some approval of the major legislative accomplishment, which he has passed already, the COVID relief bill, and may even be speaking to some support on his upcoming proposals relating to infrastructure defined in as road and bridges, and then infrastructure defined perhaps even as things like care infrastructure.
Right, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in depth. 11 bills he has signed into law, among the fewest for any newly elected president dating back to FDR. Just to run through some numbers, President Trump in his first 100 days, 28 bills, Obama 14, George W. Bush 7, Clinton 22, Roosevelt, there's the high water mark, 76. And that's why we talk about the first 100 days of a presidency. I suppose it matters how significant those bills, that legislation is. And of course, aid for the coronavirus package is what I'm trying to drive at, that was passed under Biden, certainly a huge bill. Jonathan, weigh in on this. As I search for words, you certainly have a better inventory.
Well, of course, as you say, it's not so much the quantity of bills that is passed. I mean, by that measure, Biden is pretty lackluster. But, of course, it's the content of the bills. You know, not all of Roosevelt's 76 bills passed in the first 100 days of office were incredibly consequential. A lot of them were, but not all. Biden, as you pointed out, his most consequential piece of legislation signed so far is the American Recovery Act, the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill, which is a very big deal. Just in terms of spending, just raw spending numbers, it's a lot of money. In that respect, that it's been, I think, a pretty consequential 100 days. Biden has also done a lot of executive orders. He's on pace to do more executive orders in his first 100 days than any recent president. And some of that, of course, reflects having to deal with a bitterly divided Congress. You know, in the House, the Democrats have a very slim majority in the House, and of course, they have a zero-seat majority in the Senate, one seat if you count Kamala Harris as a tiebreaker. And so given those constraints, it's difficult for Biden to, the Democrats to unilaterally pass legislation. And so, so far the Democrats have used in the Senate have used a process called reconciliation, which allows financial related bills to pass with 50 votes. But it's pretty limited. And I would expect that, we're going to see a lot more bipartisan negotiation going forward. Whether or not it pays out is another matter. Mm-hmm. But that's what I think we're going to see.
Of course, when we look at approval ratings, President Biden getting big approval ratings, favorable ratings for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And indeed, the data backs that up. Under Biden, new daily cases have dropped from an average of more than nearly 200,000 a week in the week leading up to his inauguration to just over 50,000 cases today. That's a 73% drop. And he had his big promise of 100 million vaccine shots by his 100th day. But he upped that goal to 200 million, and he hit that figure last week. One other notable bit of data I have to throw in contrast to the last president. Since taking office, Biden's at POTUS account on Twitter, averaging about 6 tweets per day. Compare that with his predecessor, who by one count, according to the New York Times, spent more than 9 full days of his presidency on Twitter until the former president was permanently suspended in January. He tweeted more than 26,000 times as president. That's roughly 18 times per day. Rene, add to where you see high marks, low marks for this president so far.
Yes, it's definitely a different type of political discourse, and maybe not a less polarized United States, but I think that the ways in which President Biden is conducting himself has returned to a sense of normalcy, which we lost for a few years during the Trump administration. And whether or not that translates into different outcomes in Washington remains to be seen. As Jonathan has mentioned, the Democratic majority is very narrow. The COVID relief bills were passed with Democratic support, and it looks like it's going to be very difficult to forge bipartisan compromise when it comes to the other major initiatives that President Biden has proposed. There's talks about it. President Biden has invited Republicans to negotiate. The same thing happened with the COVID relief bill. And so I think we're just in a situation where we're seeing a return to attempts to have politics like there used to be. But I think that the high level polarization and gridlock, which exists in Washington, is going to mean that even if the type of political discourse is different, even if we're not talking about tweets anymore, some of the same dynamics that occurred during the Trump administration are going to continue to persist over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Jonathan? Do you see an edging towards some politics, not as usual, but a little bit more as before the Trump presidency?
I tend to agree with Renee. I don't think, the GOP is not inclined to work with Joe Biden, and we'll have to see how far Joe Biden is willing to work with the GOP. Of course, during his inaugural address and during his campaign, he made lots of speeches about, bipartisan unity and being a president for all Americans. So far, his outreaches to the right have been not as robust, certainly, as Republicans would like. In fact, Mitch McConnell this morning came out and complained that, that Biden has supposedly broken his bipartisan promise. Mm-hmm. But the problem is for Biden, of course, is that many people inside the GOP now are not willing to pass any piece of legislation that Biden is willing to sign. And so, so far, Biden has been more or less playing around the GOP. And I don't know, we'll have to see to what extent he can work with them on big picture issues. A lot of that will ultimately depend, in fact, on people like Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator of West Virginia, who is widely seen as a linchpin vote in the Senate. So, for example, Mankin has come out partially opposed to Joe Biden's infrastructure proposal and said that he is willing to entertain Republican proposals. And there seems to be some negotiation between him personally and people like Lindsey Graham on the other side of the aisle. We'll have to see how those negotiations pan out. I'm not terribly optimistic but that it'll work. But I suppose if it does, then we can see more bipartisan action going forward.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, political scientist Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University, Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions, your observations about Joe Biden's nearly first 100 days in office. We're at day 98. Friday will be day 100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Peter is joining us from Des Moines on the phone. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, my comment on President Biden, he had the courage to stand up to the Turkish government, tell them no, tell them that we're going to recognize the Armenian genocide. This was done on the 24th. And in the face of a considerable amount of political and monetary pressure that the Turkish government has put on politicians in this country, he had the courage to do it where no other president has done and been willing to do it in the past. So I commend him for that. Being Armenian, obviously, that is significant to me and my family and what our family went through.
You have Armenian ancestry, Peter.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see if we have comment from Jonathan. You have foreign policy expertise. I'm not sure if it's in this area, but this is the killing of Armenians around the First World War. I think 1.5 million is the estimate there. Jonathan, your thoughts on what Peter raises here?
Yeah. Sure. It's a great comment from Peter. I mean, this is something that sort of slipped past the radar in American politics, but of course, overseas, it's a bigger deal. So, you know, the background, right, is that around World War One, in the early part of the 20th century, the then Ottoman Empire massacred, you know, as you said, over a million Armenians. And the U.S. has refused to declare it a genocide, although Congress has passed resolutions over the years doing so in the face of Turkish opposition. Biden is the first president to do so. You know, I think it really comes in part in the wake of really declining relationships between the U.S. and Turkey. Turkey is a NATO member. And so the U.S., of course, and Turkey have a mutual defense treaty through NATO. But Turkey in recent years has not been seen as a reliable security partner. They bought Russian-made anti-aircraft systems. They have not, the previous administrations have not seen Turkish cooperation in the Middle East in ways that they would like. And so, and especially in recent years, the relationship between the Turkish dictator president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and the U.S. government has really deteriorated. And so I think something like this was going to come eventually. You know, it couldn't have come earlier when relations with Turkey were good, basically.
Mm-hmm. Rene, I want to talk a little bit about what you mentioned more a little bit earlier in the program, in the infrastructure. This evening at his first address before the joint session of Congress, the president will propose a sweeping $1.8 trillion plan for national paid family leave, universal pre-kindergarten, free community college, subsidized child care. In other words, a dramatic federal expansion of the safety, social safety net for families, for children. It's the second piece of what he's calling the Build Back Better economic agenda. Following the release of the $2.3 trillion infrastructure and jobs plan, remember, that's earlier this month, that first part. This family's plan includes a $1 trillion in spending over the next 10 years, also has an additional $800 billion in targeted tax credits for the middle class. So Democrats expanding the definition, Rene, of infrastructure beyond roads, bridges, waterways, saying we need to address all systems that contribute to a thriving economy. Republicans rejecting this rebranding. Rene, do we know which definition of infrastructure Americans are going with?
Well, regardless of what you call it, we do know from some polling that the proposals which President Biden is putting forth have a fairly good degree of popular support. Again, it's still polarized, there's still division, but you're getting in situations where a majority of Americans tend to be supportive. But I think the sequence here is really important. We've had COVID relief. The president first presented the physical infrastructure bill and is now presenting the care infrastructure bill. And so I fear that we're going to see a little bit of fatigue here in the sense that it's going to be very difficult to pass three major pieces of legislation all along party line votes. And that's going to put a lot of pressure, I think, towards having some attempt at bipartisan compromise when we get to the care infrastructure portion of this legislation. And that's going to be very difficult to do if it's in one bill. And I think that that's going to create some pressure to perhaps break the legislation up. And even if you do that, as Jonathan was mentioning earlier, the ability to forge bipartisan compromise is very, very, very challenging. And I think that if the president had perhaps reversed the order and put the care infrastructure before the physical infrastructure, maybe that would play out a little bit differently. But I think the sequence here is ultimately going to be make it very, very difficult for this to be passed in the same way that the COVID relief bill was passed and in the same way that I suspect the bills for physical infrastructure will be passed.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what do you see here coming up? Rene, not terribly optimistic.
I tend to disagree with Rene a little bit. The Senate parliamentarian came out recently and said that it may be the case that reconciliation can be used more times than it originally appeared. So originally, reconciliation was supposed to be a very, very rare procedure used for budget bills. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, consulted with the Senate parliamentarian, and she ruled, I guess, informally that actually this reconciliation procedure can be used more. That's kind of the threat here, right? So Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader, is basically saying to his Republican colleagues that if you don't compromise, we can maybe push this through on reconciliation. Now, that said, Joe Manchin, again, is skeptical about this using reconciliation too much. And so if I don't know, I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic than Rene that a bill can get passed through this process. I don't know what that bill is going to look like, but I think it's likely that there'll be something that'll come out of this, even if it doesn't end up getting very much GOP support.
Mm-hmm. In the 5 minutes we have before we go to break, let's touch on this. Maybe we'll have it on the other end of the break as well, the southern border crisis. We see in these first 100-day polls very high support for the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, moderately successful polling for his handling of the economy, but widespread worries in the polling about his management of the U.S. southern border. This is his worst polling issue. Last month, over 170,000 migrants taken into custody by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. That's the highest total in nearly 20 years. The GOP blaming Joe Biden for the influx and criticizing his response. This is an area of expertise for you, Rene, immigration area. How do you analyze what's going on at the southern border, the current surge, the thousands of unoccupied minors crossing, needing to be detained, others, of course, being turned back, and the public opinion of the handling of it?
Yeah, well, I think we see a major disjunction between what is going on in the media and perhaps what the public thinks and what's really happening along the southwest border. So the numbers in 2021, as far as people entering, even the number of unaccompanied minors, is far in excess of what was happening in 2020. There's no question about that. But if you compare April of 2021 to April of 2020, it's not necessarily very useful because, well, April of 2020 was a very weird time. And like much of the world shut down, even migrant flows into the United States were shutting down. And so the appropriate point of comparison is really 2019. And the numbers between 2021 and 2019 actually aren't that different. They're a little higher in 2021, but not that much. And so the idea that there's a surge is a little bit of a false media narrative. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't flows and that the flows aren't significant and that there's a stressing, perhaps, of our capacity to detain and process individuals who are apprehended. But the idea that we have a flow which is really outside of historical norms is not necessarily reflective of what the data do show. And laying the blame on President Biden, saying, well, President Biden created or encouraged the surge. Well, when you had a big increase in 2019 relative to what you saw in 2018, I don't think very many people were saying that President Trump created the 2019 surge. And so I think that there's just a little bit of a situation where when there's a Democrat in office and there's a increase in the number of people entering the United States, you lay the blame on the Democratic president. But when you have somebody like President Trump, because he was so hard on immigration in terms of both his policy and rhetoric, there just was a tendency to not blame increases in flows on him, even though they happened during his tenure.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Haseeb, do you see it the same way?
I do. You know, I mean, presidents, for better or worse, get blamed or praised for what happens with national events that are mostly out of their control. You know, that's how it works. I mean, presidents get the blame for a good economy and the credit for a good economy and the blame for a poor one, even though presidential tenure actually has very little impact on economic growth. So the same thing is true with immigration. You know, Biden obviously isn't personally out there directing people to come to the United States, but this is an issue that the GOP is going to use to hammer Biden for a long time. You know, this is something that, as Ben, as you pointed out, the polling isn't very favorable for Biden. And this is also something that Republicans, a message that Republicans can coalesce around at a time when they're having a really hard time finding a message, finding a way to attack Biden. You know, the various attacks that the GOP has attempted to make on Biden's plan so far have mostly not resonated. This seems to be the issue that really drives a lot of the Republican base. And so I would expect that we're going to see, you know, sustained Republican attention to this issue, whether, you know, regardless of what Biden does, because, you know, it polls well for the GOP. And it's just about the only thing right now that does poll well for the GOP and can fire up their base successfully. So the attacks on this issue are going to continue.
Okay. Yeah, I'm reading, too. Republican strategists say immigration, that's their issue, their galvanizing issue for the 2022 midterm elections. And it sounds like may agree. We're going to go to break. When we come back for Renee and Jonathan, I have some audio to play for all of us to get your thoughts on how Republicans are messaging during this pandemic. Also thoughts on that bill advancing in the Iowa legislature that would ban government entities, schools, and businesses from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccination, so-called limiting vaccine passports. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment with Rene Rocha and Jonathan Haseeb on this edition of River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University and Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa, our two political scientists, picking over some of the themes and news on our political landscape. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Of course, this evening, President Biden delivering his first address before a joint session of Congress. I'll ask them shortly before we leave you this hour about what they'll be listening for, getting through some other things, including last half hour, talking about the president's approval ratings in the first nearly 100 days in office, wide support for President Biden's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, but widespread worries about his management of the U.S. southern border. That's his worst polling issue. Ryan is with us from in Newton and wants to talk about something, ask a question in connection with that. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. So I guess my question to you guys here is, considering Biden's handling of the, you know, I guess we're calling it a crisis there at the southern border with a, you know, an influx of, I don't know if it's fair to call it an influx of immigrants, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be a prudent move for Biden to allocate some of that border funding towards improving our court system there in an effort to more efficiently process these asylum claims and the immigrant applications along the way in an effort to provide a path to citizenship in a more expeditious manner, considering we have so many of them that are ending up in these detention centers along the way, whether they're undocumented children or seasonal workers or people fleeing their persecution in these Latin American countries. It would seem to me that the best course of action, considering what we've got going on there, is to find ways to integrate them into our society in a more efficient manner than we're currently doing. What's your take on that?
Okay, Ryan in Newton, thank you very much. I'll toss that to Rene. Rene, what do you think of Ryan's comment?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of very interesting and good points made there. When we think about how to address it, there's, you know, it's a very difficult problem. It's a very big problem. It seems very intractable, but there are concrete things you can do in the short term and in the long term. And one of the things which the Biden administration is trying to develop are increasing funding for, like Ryan was saying, building up the court system so that you can more efficiently process asylum claims, so that you don't have the situation where claims are lingering and that certain people might be held in detention or might be waiting just for their claims to be adjudicated for very, very long periods of time. That's one way of trying to deal with the issue in the short term. In the long term, we're talking about things like changing what's happening in some of the countries in which immigrants are coming from. So Vice President Harris met earlier this week with the president of Guatemala to think about ways in which we can be working with the Guatemalan government to reinforce Guatemalan society so that there's fewer people trying to leave Guatemala and enter the United States. And so there are short-term things and there are very long-term things. Those long-term things are going to be issues that whoever's president after Joe Biden is also going to have to deal with, and probably the person after that. And so short-term, long-term, things that you can do, we'll just have to see where politics takes us over the next couple of years to determine whether or not there's real forward movement or whether or not any efforts that the Biden administration takes sort of fizzle out when the next occupant of the Oval Office comes in.
Okay, thanks for that question from Newton. Ryan, let's move to some COVID politics. I want to play some clips and get your thoughts, Renee and Jonathan, on how Republicans are messaging during this pandemic. This is interesting. Republican members of Congress and GOP senators with medical training just released a video appealing to the public to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Let's listen to a portion of it.
Look, this vaccine is safe. Operation Warp Speed brought us safe and effective vaccines, and all in record time.
The process was rigorous and transparent, and a process that I personally followed very, very closely,
resulting in a clear path to the eradication of the pandemic. The FDA did not skip any steps.
Instead, they cut bureaucratic red tape, not corners, and they got the job done in record time.
And by now, over 100 million vaccines have been given in our country.
And it's obvious to me from a medical standpoint, the only way to protect ourselves and your loved ones
and to end the government's restrictions on our freedoms is to take action and get the vaccine.
Okay, that was in order. Representative Larry Buckshom, doctor of in Indiana, Representative John Joyce, also an MD of Pennsylvania, Representative Brian Babin, a dentist from Texas, Representative Andy Harris, a doctor from Maryland, Representative Michael Burgess, a doctor from Texas, Senator John Barrasimo, an MD from Wyoming, and Representative Greg Murphy, an MD from North Carolina, all Republicans. Jonathan, I don't know if you saw this full video, but it's interesting because right now we have, well, Republican politicians in an interesting position here in trying to encourage their constituents, traditional Republican followers, to get the vaccine because they are shown to be most hesitant, according to polls.
That's right. You know, polling shows that about 40% of GOP voters say that they will not get the vaccine. And when you drill down a little bit more, it seems like you've got about 20 to 25% of the Republican Party who are absolute refusers, who will under no circumstances get the vaccine. But that still leaves, you know, maybe 15-20% of this 40% who won't get vaccinated or who are persuadable. And you know, that's what these kind of messages are doing. But it's tricky for the GOP. Mostly because of Donald Trump, right? So Donald Trump, was the executive who launched Operation Warp Speed and helped, you know, develop the process that these vaccines were created under. But of course, he is not promoting vaccine use publicly. He's been vaccinated, but he's done it privately. He's not touting vaccination. And we're now at the point in the United States where many millions of Republicans will only trust Donald Trump. They won't trust local representatives. They will not trust other members of the Republican Party. They will only trust Trump. And so until and if the former president does some sort of public service announcement to tout the fact that he himself has been vaccinated, I think we're going to see a lot of vaccine hesitancy in this constituency. And I don't know how much. I mean, it's great that these Republican representatives are doing this, but I don't know how much it's going to move the needle.
Mm-hmm. Let me play another bit of audio clip and get Renee's comment on this. Here in Iowa, a bill advancing in the legislature that would ban government entities, schools and businesses from requiring proof of a COVID vaccination. Businesses that violate the bill wouldn't qualify for state-funded grants or contracts. The bill also prohibits state and local government agencies from issuing any ID cards that say whether you have a COVID vaccine. Nicole Hasso of Johnston says she supports the bill because individuals should get to decide if they want to be vaccinated or not.
For someone to tell me that I can't go and shop, or if I can't go to my son's basketball game because I'm not vaccinated, that's against the rules. That is against my constitutional rights.
Renee Rocha, comment on this whole area, the GOP dealing with messaging during this pandemic and this and these so-called passports, vaccine passports.
Yeah, I mean, we've really seen the politicalization of public health, which has been one of the most difficult things during this crisis. And this is sort of awkward territory for Republicans, because if you think about it, what the argument here is that, well, you have to oppose vaccine passports because you're supporting individual rights. But what you're also doing is you're regulating businesses. You're telling businesses they're not allowed to make decisions about whether or not they're going to open to particular clientele or not. And so this sort of couching support for individual rights is regulation of small businesses, a little bit of a pretzel knot, I think, for the Republican Party. But given the way that COVID has been so politicized, and that given the way in which certain elements within the Republican Party have really taken a anti-vaccination position, not the majority of the party. You have individuals like Governor Reynolds still going out encouraging everybody to get vaccinated, but particular segments of the members of the party. This is the situation in which we find ourselves in, and it is a little odd. You can imagine a world, like Jonathan was just saying, well, what if former President Trump did a public service announcement? You can imagine a world in which the former president was going out there taking full credit for Operation Warp Speed, saying, I'm the reason that we got the vaccine in this record time. Look at the amazing accomplishment and legacy of my administration. That could have been an alternative path, but that's not the situation in which we find ourselves today.
Jonathan, comment about this and what Renee brought up. I mean, Republicans supposedly stand behind retailers. You have your own business. You decide how you want to run it. And I've certainly seen businesses have a sign in the doorway, say all of our employees have been vaccinated. That's a selling point. That's a businessman or woman trying to get an atmosphere where people come back to the shops.
That's right. I mean, you're pitting, you know, two constitutional rights against each other. I mean, this is going to be something that the courts will adjudicate. And I'm not an attorney, so I have no idea how it'll come out.
But it seems to me that the GOP, that this proposed legislation seeks to regulate how private businesses run their own affairs, which is, you know, which poses some constitutional and legal questions that are going to have to be resolved. And as Renee pointed out, there's a strange tension here between individual rights and corporate rights, which we've seen on other issues, too. You know, Mitch McConnell a couple of weeks ago told corporations to stay out of politics, which was an odd thing for him to do for someone who supported the Citizens United decision and has supported corporate money in politics for many years, to turn around and demand that corporations stay out of politics. It shows that the GOP can't quite decide where they come down now on corporate power and corporate rights. And we'll have to see. We're in the middle of a transition on this issue, and I don't know where the GOP is going to come down in the end.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Haseeb with us, as well as Rene Rocha, our two political scientists. Jonathan from ISU, Rene from the University of Iowa. A couple of other points I wanted to have comment from the both of you on. We were coming up on the year anniversary of George Floyd's death last May. Dozens of states and local governments have changed their laws about police behavior, including here in Iowa. Quickly, Rene, first of all, your thoughts on the politics of policing reform, the racial reckoning caused by the Chauvin trial, of course, the death of George Floyd, and all of the protests we saw in 2020.
Well, I've been a little bit encouraged by some of the events of the past week. We've seen that Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced pattern and practice investigations in both the Minneapolis and the Louisville police departments. And that's going to perhaps create real introspection analysis of different police tactics. It's going to encourage the adoption of reforms that will ultimately potentially lower use of force instances and therefore maybe even save lives. And somewhere in the space between ideas like police abolition and a refusal to even acknowledge implicit bias in policing are ideas like this, are moves and reforms like these pattern and practice investigations and the problematic tactics that they uncover. And so I think it really shows what a thoughtful and assertive Department of Justice can do in this area. It's something that we didn't have back when Attorney General Barr was in that position. He famously did not authorize a pattern and practice investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department. And so I think that hopefully we'll see some real positive developments in this area over the next few years.
Jonathan, anything to add to what Rene said on the politics of policing reform?
Yeah, I mean, the thing to remember here is that the United States has incredibly decentralized policing. I mean, there are thousands of different public safety departments around the country, right? Most other countries have a national police force or state police forces. The United States has this incredible patchwork of thousands of different public safety departments. And so, you know, even a really active Department of Justice simply cannot monitor all of these places. And so if change is going to happen, it has to happen. There has to be a cultural change nationally and inside policing. And that may be underway now. Of course, it's too early to tell, but I'm like Renee, I'm sort of cautiously optimistic that there may be a cultural change around how policing is done. And that's what has to happen to control in this incredibly decentralized system. It can't come from the top, at least not as U.S. policing is currently designed.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. Let's squeeze in one more caller. Lynn from Iowa City coming up to the end of the hour. Lynn, sure glad you're here. Cut to the chase. What do you have for us today? Welcome, Lynn.
Well, I would like comments on the article in the New York Times that focused on Burlington and what's ahead for the Democratic Party in the state.
Right. That was a New York Times article. I actually have that headline here, Lynn, in front of me. Why Iowa has become such a heartbreaker for Democrats, and the subheadline, the 2020 carnage for the party was deep in the state, one of many where economic decline and social malaise helped fuel Donald Trump's rise. Now Democrats face the pivotal question of whether to abandon both Iowa and its first in the nation caucuses. Jonathan, I'm not sure you, along with Lynn, read that article this morning in the New York Times.
Yeah, I saw it when it came out. It's, you know, I think the GOP and places like in rural states like Iowa is currently more of a cultural organization than a political one. You know, there aren't the Republican Party doesn't have a lot of coherent policy proposals anymore. And in fact, there was recent polling that suggested that a much larger percentage of Republican voters think it's more important to fight cultural issues, that they feel that their country is getting away from them, than it is to push particular policy reform. And when that happens, there's just not much Democrats can do to appeal to, you know, Republican-leaning rural Iowans, because these are people who are invested in the GOP as a cultural force, as a way to, you know, do lots of things. I mean, among others, maintain what they feel is a declining status inside American society. And so to the extent that these are cultural issues, there's not much that the Democrats can do. You know, these are people who are essentially on Team R, and they're not going to budge, most of them, because it's not about particular policies.
Right. And five of six of our congressional members since the last election are, in your words, Jonathan, on Team R, if you want to put it that way, in the Republican corner, where, of course, for several years, we've had a governor, a Republican governor, and also unified Republican control in our legislature. What do you think, Renee? Are there prospects for a return to what used to be called our purple or bellwether status?
Yeah, well, you know, that election in the 2nd Congressional District of Iowa was a real wake-up call for the Democrats, I think, and really highlighted the declining influence of the party within the state. I think that really what we've seen here is a willingness to embrace populism in parts of rural Iowa and in similar parts of the country. I think this is true of some rural areas of Wisconsin if you look at how politics has shifted in that state over time. And one of the things that happened with President Trump is he was really able to tap into this populist sentiment. Whether or not the Republican Party remains a party of populism going forward is something that will have to be negotiated as they go through their presidential nominating contest over the next few years. And we'll see what happens with the Democratic Party. You know, we have people like Bernie Sanders who maybe could also have tapped into a little bit of that sentiment, although I don't necessarily think that there are figures like Senator Sanders elsewhere in the Democratic Party that really have that sort of popular sentiment. I think the Republican Party has more populace within their ranks, and so I think that they'll sort of have an advantage in that going forward and in really galvanizing individuals who are very open to that type of messaging.
A quick comment from the two of you for this evening's the first address by this president before a joint session of Congress. Jonathan, you get the first minute, and I'll then dish off the second minute to Rene, if that works for you. Tim Scott of South Carolina, the Republican, the Senate's only black Republican, delivering the GOP rebuttal to Biden. What will you be watching, Jonathan?
I'll be watching to see, you know, how specific Biden is going to be on paying for this. He's already said that, you know, unlike this isn't going to be deficit spending entirely. It's going to be based on things like increasing the corporate tax rate and increasing capital gains tax rates. So it'll be interesting to see how specific he gets on that, because, of course, tax increases is the one thing that everyone in the GOP opposes. And so if Biden is really specific about saying we're going to pay for it with this tax increase and that tax increase, I think that signals that it's more likely that the bill that comes out will not be passed with any GOP support.
Even if
that's really one of the few things that the GOP can unite around.
Right, Jonathan. Even if Biden manages, and it seems this is what he wants to do, is to sort of cleave off the top money makers in our country from the rest of us and put that narrative through.
Right. And of course, these are, you know, donors, or I should say a class of voters who the GOP has traditionally courted. You know, they've pushed for reduction of corporate tax rates. They've pushed for rates and reduced rates for, you know, very wealthy Americans. And so if Biden is pushing for tax increases on those people, this is going to be a complete non-starter on the other side of the aisle.
Okay.
And so if Biden talks a lot about the tax increases, I think to me that's a signal that, you know, serious bipartisan negotiations are not going to happen around this issue.
Okay, we'll be listening for that. Rene Rocha, you get the final word. What will you be watching for, listening for this evening?
There's a lot of substantive points, but I'm also interested in the aesthetics of what's going to happen. These events are largely pop and circumstance, and they're a way of really cementing the presidency of a new president. And we'll see how it works with 200 people spread around trying to adhere to COVID and safety protocols, and whether or not that affects the way it comes out on TV. Maybe that's not the most important thing, but given that these are largely TV events, I'll be curious to see how it plays out.
Okay, thank you very much, the two of you, for your analysis this hour. Rene Rocha, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Jonathan Hasid, associate professor of political science at ISU. Jonathan and Rene, thank you very much for a wonderful hour sharing your insights with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you.
And tomorrow on this program, two presidential historians, Tim Walsh and Tim Naftali, weigh in on what it means, the mile marker of the president's first 100 days. Where did it come from? Is it a good predictor of president's success? That's tomorrow on our program. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez and Rick Brewer. Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.